Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Saturday, June 24th, 2023. Of course, the website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit the Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do consider subscribing to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org. for all the details. All right, today I am joined by Rolo Slavsky, an independent investigator and blogger covering Russia and Eastern Europe. All right, Rolo Slavsky, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Good, glad to be on, glad to talk to you.
Yeah, man, thanks for joining me. I've been following your Substack for a few months now, and I came across your work along with your friend and colleague, Riley Wagaman, some time ago. And I think you guys are really doing some outstanding work presenting information and perspectives about Russia and the conflict in Ukraine that really you won't find anywhere else, at least in the English, you know, the English language independent media. So I want to start off by saying I really appreciate what you guys are doing. I do subscribe to both you and Riley on your Substack pages. I picked up a year membership a few weeks ago, and I would encourage our listeners here to this podcast to consider doing the same thing to support your work. Riley was a guest on The Realist Report, and anyone that's interested can find that interview in the archives on my website, therealistreport.com. So, Rolo, with that being said, can you start off by just introducing yourself to our listeners? Tell us about your background and your experience in the independent media.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for supporting me and for the advertisement. And it's awesome that you read Riley as well. We've dovetailed and we've started talking about a lot of similar stuff. He originally was more focused on COVID and that sort of thing. But I guess it's all related at this point. So about me, I have been writing for a while, almost 10 years now, but it was not... I was working in Russia, and I only went independent, I suppose. I started out after the Eskimo began by submitting a few articles, which kept ones, and they were very positive because I was very optimistic that things were going to change in Russia. And I hadn't ever really written about Russia before because I thought it would be depressing. It just, you know, for someone with my perspective who... I consider myself, you know, conservative, patriotic, I'm pro-American and pro-Russian, and I'm basically pro anybody that's being oppressed by their occupation government. And I thought that, you know, Americans and Russians actually have a lot in common, especially the MAGA type voter with the average Russian patriot. For me, it was never like I just didn't want to have bad news to report. And with the start of the SMO, I was pretty sure that things were about to look up. And in the beginning, there was a lot of helpful, hopeful news. There was a lot of people in the media fled. There was some of the faces in Russia, the worst personalities, fled to either Armenia or to Israel or to Latvia. So it looked like there was going to be a big cleanup. And that was sort of what my impetus was to start writing, was that I'd have something good to say and I'd have something positive to talk about. And by basically the end of the summer, I realized that things were not going in the direction that I expected them to go, and that goes the same for the war. I get accused a lot by independent media. I'm using air quotes here because I don't think they're independent. I don't think they're alternative. I think that there are some of them, I think, are bought and paid for, because it's very hard to understand the rationale for reporting on things the way that they do. Well, anyway, that's when my love affair with independent media ended, and I can't really get out anymore, and I'm not linked anymore. And, you know, I had people linking my stuff when I was positive in the beginning, and they were saying, like, this is like a great writer. He's so smart. He's really got things figured out. He's got this really unique perspective. And that gave me my initial boost. But immediately, as things started going south and I started providing a different perspective, that's when I became like a bête noire. And ever since then, it's been just, you know, it's been slow, but I've been growing like in opposition to these so-called alternative independent media voices. And I've learned that it's basically one big mafia. I've learned that they stifle any actual independent thought. And I've learned that, you know, there's so many layers to the con, like and that people are just not willing to understand that, you know, everyone wants to always default to the two-dimensional black and white thinking. It doesn't matter what it is. There's like this human tendency to just fall back on this very simplistic thinking. And I just don't understand how people can do that after they spent, you know, after COVID happened and after all these strange events, all these fake events, all these psyoped events. You'd think people start asking more questions, but I haven't noticed that. So I hope that answers your question. That's my like relation to independent media. I don't think they're independent. I have no relationship with them anymore, except in an antagonistic one. So yeah.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, and you and Riley both, you guys, you know, write pretty critically of, you know, quote unquote pro-Russian, Western, quote unquote independent media. And yeah, I think you raise a lot of good points. Now, I'm actually over on UNS.com because you were syndicated for a while by UNS.com, right? Maybe not every single article you wrote, but quite a few of them going back to like early 2022.
I think the last one was probably like in December or November. And it was about like things were starting to look bleak for Russia. And that's the last one, yeah.
Yeah, the most recent one that I see anyways is from February 22nd of this year. And that article was Russia has no strategy for winning this war. Almost 550 comments. So it generated quite the discussion. And UNS.com is a great website. There's a lot of interesting articles always posted on that site. But yeah, no, I think you definitely make a lot of good points. And your perspective and sort of outlook and assessment of this special military operation, which you describe actually as a not war, which is something I want to ask you more about, is very interesting and certainly worth at least considering, even if, you know, you maybe wouldn't necessarily agree with all of your conclusions. Now, real quick, though, am I understanding this correctly? Your family background is like Russian, but you're born in America?
No, my family's from Ukraine, but they're, you know, we considered ourselves Russians. And if you want to like go back further than that, like the previous generation, we lived in Kazakhstan. And then before that, we had family in St. Petersburg and in Kubань, which is area. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I think there's moments when you kind of cut out. I thought you were done speaking. But basically, I mean, yeah, your background is more or less in part of the old Russian Empire, right?
Yeah.
Or the historic Russian Empire, yeah. And you currently live in Russia, or you live in Eastern Europe? I know it sounds like just reading you, you've definitely traveled in Russia and lived in Russia and in other parts of Eastern Europe. Is that right?
Well, what happened was when COVID hit, I had nowhere to go, so I had to go to Ukraine. And then I realized things were going to get hairy. And so I moved to Belarus, where I had a family and where I had a permanent residence. Like I have a blood right to claim it. And so I was there and doing my paperwork and becoming naturalized, I guess you could say. And then what happened was I went for a month and I was going to start a gig in Russian media again. And then when I tried to come back a second time from Minsk, I got arrested at the border and I was held in isolation for like 2 days and questioned by the FSB. And they, I guess they didn't like my answers. And I wasn't writing at that time. The blog came after, or like almost immediately after. But So yeah, I got arrested, and then they gave me a 5-year ban, and they kicked me out back to Belarus. And then when I was in Belarus, I was just going about my life and just saying, okay, well, that sucks that I can't go to Russia, but you know, Belarus is fine. And then the KGB came, and they threatened to deport me to Ukraine, even though I had the documentation that like I had a right to be in Belarus. And if I had been able to get into Russia, I would have been able to claim Russian citizenship as well, but they didn't let me. So then I got kicked out of Belarus because they threatened me with deportation to Ukraine. So I had to go to Georgia, but it got too expensive and it was too depressing. And then I left from there, and I won't say where I am now, but I'm not in Russia.
Wow. Boy, so yeah, you've definitely been through quite a lot the past couple of years, it sounds like. Well, that's interesting. A very interesting story, very interesting background. And you know, like I said, you know, anybody, check out your website. I guess it's your Substack, the Slavland Chronicles. I'll have it linked when I post this podcast program. And then I also follow you on Twitter. Do you actually have an official Telegram channel? I wasn't able to find it, if you do.
No, I don't. Do you think, I don't think a lot of English speakers are on Telegram. Maybe I should. I don't know. But I spend a lot of time on Telegram, but I don't have a channel, no.
Okay, yeah. Well, I do follow you on Twitter, and of course, I follow you on your Substack page, which is where you'll find all of your more longer form articles. And then, like I said, there is an archive for you over at uns.com, but most of the articles are from like 2022, and then just a couple from this year. About what you describe as the not war in Ukraine. What do you mean by this? Could you kind of elaborate on this concept of the not war?
Well, it's a joke on some levels. The first is that you're not allowed to say war in Russia. It's called the special military operation. And people have gotten in trouble for saying that. Mostly people who deserved it, to be fair. But on another level, there's this sort of official policy of like burying the head in the sand that the Kremlin has, where it seems like they, you know, how do I put it? It's like they're in denial about it. So it's when I say the not war, it's like I'm not going to call it a special military operation because that's lunacy. That's like Orwellian speak. This is a serious war, but I'm not allowed to say war technically. So I'll call it a not war. That's my thinking there. It is a war. I mean, maybe the reasons for it, not the ones given. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say you and Riley recently did a podcast where you kind of talk about the origins of the conflict and this secret peace treaty that was just recently exposed, which really has not received any coverage in either the independent media or the mainstream media in the West, at least that I've seen, at least nothing major. You know, this to me was a pretty big revelation, a pretty major story that I know you covered quite a bit on your Substack. Riley talked about it as well. And in that podcast, you made an interesting observation. You basically described the conflict in Ukraine and the origins of this special military operation as basically a war between competing oligarchic factions in Russia and Ukraine. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the conclusion I'm forced to come to. And I'm sorry, I just want to preface this by saying I am like pro-Russia. I lived in Russia for many years. My friends are in Russia Project, where I basically promote Russian patriotism. I talk about Russian culture. I interact entirely with Russians. I almost got married to a Russian woman twice. And you know, it's where I want to be. It's where I was trying to get to, but the spooks wouldn't let me in. So I just want to say that my perspective is it's not pro-Ukrainian. I think that these lands should be united. I think they have a common history with each other. I think the fact that we're divided is what leads to these conflicts. It allows outside powers to foment conflict. I'm not naive. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it would be a utopia. But I do think that the life of an average Ukrainian would, if not get better, it would not get significantly worse. It's definitely not worth fighting. It's not worth dying for something like this. So that's my perspective. So if I critique Russia, it's not from the perspective of I'm pro-Ukrainian or I'm pro-NATO or something. And I always get accused of that, and it's I guess it's a little bit, I'm used to it, but it's still a little bit frustrating. It's yeah, anyway, sorry.
No, that's, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Could you like elaborate on this concept, like this basically a conflict between competing oligarchs in Russia and Ukraine is what led to this conflict. And you guys were actually getting into like the Maidan coup, like, you know, going back to like 2013, 2014. I mean, that whole situation is still a little bit mysterious to me. I mean, my basic understanding is that the Maidan coup was like this Western-backed revolution designed to topple a more or less pro-Russian government and install an anti-Russian regime friendly with the neocons running, you know, the American empire and U.S. foreign policy. Would you agree with that? Like, could you kind of maybe just talk us through like the background of this and what led up to the current special, quote unquote, special military operation?
Well, that's a misconception that Yanukovych was pro-Russian. He really wasn't. There hasn't been a pro-Russian president of Ukraine. It's only gone from bad to worse. But it already started out pretty badly with by the time, like with Kuchma, for example, who, you know, came before this. Kuchma is routinely portrayed as being the pro-Russian guy who lost to Yushchenko, who was the pro-West guy. But this isn't true. Kuchma was very anti-Russian. He wrote a book where he called Russians Asiatic mongrel Mongols. Like he said, a cleaner race, and the Russians are just a horde of Finnic, Turkic Mongols. Yeah, basically. So both mongrels, meaning mixed, and Mongols, meaning, you know, Genghis Khan. And so that's the guy who is portrayed as being pro-Russian. And so he was toppled. You had the first Maidan, which was the Orange Revolution. And I have this very in-depth article, and it tells the story of this famous journalist named Gangadze, who was tied up in this whole affair. And Gangadze was this half Georgian, half Galician journalist who had ties with American intelligence and who was receiving money through U.S. aid. And he was helping send freedom fighters or terrorists, take your pick, to Georgia to fight against Russians and Russian-backed separatists in Abkhazia and Ossetia. And then he was helping these Ukrainians from Galicia also go and join the Chechens and fight against the Russians there. So his whole career was basically being anti-Russian and getting U.S. Spook, black budget money. Or I guess open, I don't know, it's USAID, so who knows, I guess it's legit, to promote anti-Russian narratives. And so he was promoting this narrative that Kuchma was pro-Russian, when Kuchma literally wrote a book where he called Russians subhumans. And Kuchma's policy was actually to try and, you know, get cozy with the West. What happened was, Gangadze was attacking Kuchma so much that Kuchma got really mad, and he put out a hit on him. Either it was to, like, my theory, my version of the story is that the thugs from the secret police that Kuchma sicked on Gangadze weren't intended to kill him, just to rough him. They went too far and they killed him. And then they had to hide the body somehow. So they chopped off his head and split his carcass in several places. But it was found almost immediately. It created an international uproar. The U.S. was very upset, and this led to a proto-Maidan movement. It led to a lot of things. A cascading domino effect was set into motion, and Russia was tied up with this, and Russia was blamed for this, for like giving the order to put the hit out on Gangadze through Kuchma, which is absurd. And I have this, I go pretty in depth with that article, but the narrative stuck that Kuchma was this pro-Russian guy when in reality he wasn't. So then you have Yushchenko, who was openly, you know, pro-West. And that's when a lot of these networks are set up. Well, they were set up even before that. Like it used to be that the Republicans were the ones looting Ukraine. We know about the Bidens and the political kickbacks from sending aid to Ukraine. They were doing it before the war. And so we sort of associate this as like a DNC money laundering scheme. But before that, it was the Republicans who were doing the same thing. And at some point, the DNC muscled them out or something like that. Anyway, point being is it's the same story with Yanukovych. Yanukovych is also portrayed as this pro-Russian guy. He was not. You know, Yanukovych, first and foremost, I mean, he was an absolute cretin. But you cannot call him pro-Russian. In fact, he was so, you know, he did a lot of the stuff he did, you know, he was really pissing off Russia. And so when he did get toppled, first of all, Russia encouraged his toppling in the sense that they told him that they would not approve of him using lethal force against the protesters. So even Moscow wanted him gone. And then when he was supposed to raise his flag and sort of like go east to his strong, to like, you know, rally people around him and do something, I guess, either go into opposition politics or maybe even something more drastic to fight against the new people in Kiev that came to power following the Euromaidan. Someone put the kibosh on that as well. And they were like, we don't want anything to do with this guy. And they whisked him off to Rostov in Russia. And no one's really heard about from him since. So this idea that Yanukovych was pro-Russian is not true. Would he have allowed the situation where a war starts with Russia? Actually, probably. If there was a rebellion in Donbass, started following the events of Euromaidan, and Yanukovych was a president, I'm pretty sure he'd do the same thing as Poroshenko, and he'd probably send in, you know, the special police and tanks and stuff, and he'd probably kill a lot of people. Yanukovych, disgusting individual, but there's really no way you can call him pro-Russian. And people who say that, they don't really understand politics in Ukraine. And like you asked me to elaborate about the oligarchic thing, well, the thing is that Ukraine has been ruled by oligarchic clans from Donbass. Donbass has ruled Ukraine pretty much since it's, you know, they ruled it when it was still the Soviet Union, and they continued to rule it in the aftermath of the breakup. Why? Well, because Donbass was a heavily industrialized zone, and there was also raw materials there, like coal. And so it's a very criminal region. It's with deep criminal ties that have extended through families. And so, I mean, even like Tymoshenko, I don't know if your listeners are aware of who she is. She's a famous opposition to Kuchma and to Yanukovych, politician. She's famous because she does that hairstyle. You know what I'm talking about? Looks like bread.
I remember her. Yeah. This is going back to like 2007, 2008 back then, right? When she was involved.
Yeah. This is Orange Revolution.
Yeah.
A bit before that. So she's portrayed as this like pro-Western, pro-Ukrainian type lady, but she's literally from the same mafia network from the east. She's not even Russian or Ukrainian.
She's Jewish. Yes.
So she dyed her hair blonde, got a nose job. I mean, you should have seen her before. And she suddenly emerges as this like pro-Ukrainian, meaning like pro-Western Ukrainian, you know, pro all the good stuff against all the bad stuff, freedom fighter. And she rides into power with what's his name, Yushchenko, and then she's around in politics for a while after that. So, but she was actually like the real muscle, I guess you could say, because the people with the money, the people with the connections, with the organized crime, the syndicates, they were all from Donbass or Dnipropetrovsk, which is, you know, it's right next to it. So you have, and so to really understand Ukraine, you kind of have to know who these oligarchs are and their networks. And so the Dnipropetrovsk gang, I think it's called Dnieper now, they changed the name. The guy running that was Holomoisky, who people should know about. I'm sure you've heard of it, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Holomoisky. Yeah, he's the Jewish gangster basically that financed Zelensky and his party and has been very involved in
Azov politics.
And Azov, yeah, the so-called neo-Nazis, right?
Yeah.
At least portrayed in the West, yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, and I upset everybody when I say this, the truth about these names. Like, I actually know who they are, and like, you know, I know a guy who, you know, if you're in the nationalist scene in Russia, like, there are national. I wrote a whole article about what happened to the really in depth what happened to the Russian nationalist scene, and how basically the FSB was sending in all these provocateurs into the nationalist movement, and almost all these provocateurs ended up in Ukraine, and almost all of them ended up in some, like, either next to or in Azov. So, and the founder of Azov was Russian, and there, you know, it was Russian speaking, and it was basically calling for a union between Russia and Ukraine. There's like a lot of lore here. And so this portrayal of them in the West, that they're like these liberal, whatever, like they're honoring their heritage of resistance to the Soviet Union or something, that's total bullshit. They're conflating the Bandera people with the Azov people. And it's a distinction that no one really understands. You know, no one gives a shit, right? And in Russia, they portray them as this, it's like organic Ukrainian Nazi thing. Both of these accounts are wrong. What really happened was, and I write this in my in-depth article, and I have to speculate a little bit, because is there's a lot of really weird people in Russia and in Ukraine who, you know, coalesce in Kharkiv, right, in the city on the next to Russia. It's in Ukraine, but it's next to Russia in the east, and they start making this outfit, this basically like a paramilitary gang, and they have these really interesting beliefs. Like, for example, they really like Nietzsche. And they really like Nietzsche, right? They adopt him right around the time that Holomoisky comes knocking. And so Holomoisky is like looking for some muscle for hire. And that's basically how politics works in the Slav lands, is you hire football hooligans and prison gangs and ethnic gangs like Azeris or you know, Georgians or Chechens or whatever. You just hire and but how would they, like, you know, this is and for what it's worth, these are nationalists. They're kind of weird. Some of them are pro-Ukraine, some are pro-Russia, some are pro-both. They want, you know, union. It's completely filled with federal agents, you know, actual serving FSB agents who suddenly decided that, you know, they had like a coming to God moment. And they said, oh my God, I'm a nationalist now. I better go join, you know, a nationalist paramilitary gang in Ukraine. I mean, that's it's true. Like, there's literal FSB agents that were involved in that, and also FSB informers, weird provocateurs who were on FSB payroll to try and discredit other Russian nationalists. It's weird. So you have this thing where they get approached by Holomoisky, and all of a sudden they start getting into Nietzsche, because Nietzsche says that it would be very advantageous to have like gangs of like power hungry, triumph of the will maximizing type fighters allied with Jewish capital. Like, that's one of his big things. And so these guys read that and they're like, this is the perfect ideological justification that we need. And they adopted this weird ideology, and then they became Holomoisky's enforcers. And so then they were used in Ukraine as, you know, as muscle to basically fight over, for example, TV stations. Like, they were used to fight when Holomoisky was trying to aggressively take over a competitor's TV operation, you know, stuff like that. And so, hey, you know what I'm talking about? Like,
Well, gosh, listening to you explain this, it's like, the more I realize, like, this situation is so complex, and most people don't even.
Well, it's not. I really don't want people to like get bogged down in the details. The details are great and they're fun if you're really into this stuff. But the key takeaway here is that it's a bunch of spooks who get together, and it's a bunch of oligarchs who also get involved in this. You know, so you got spooks from both sides involved in it. You got criminals, you got weirdos, you have Jewish oligarchs, and that's the takeaway here. The rest is just details. It's very weird.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. I get it. And I guess that's my point. Is like, if you really want to get to the bottom of this, it is a very complex situation here, and it hasn't really been portrayed accurately, I don't think, in the West. And I remember reading about Holomoisky, like, back when this first started, and his connections to Zelensky, and how like this Azov group that he kind of helped organize and finance and stuff. They would go in and like, you know, Occupy, like, you know, factory that he took over or whatever, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. They would go in and like physically intimidate people in order to, you know, advance his financial and business career, essentially. Is that, at least that was sort of my takeaway from it. So all this is going on. You have all these different competing factions in Donbass and probably in other parts of Ukraine as well. But what about, so like, I guess one thing I want to, hopefully that you can help clarify for me and our listeners as well, is was there ever any genuine patriotic opposition in Donbass to this coup that was, again, from what I've read, from what I've seen, was more or less backed by the West, maybe for different reasons, or, you know, there's more to it than just a simply overthrowing a pro-Russian regime, which, as you said, really wasn't even pro-Russian to begin with. But was there like a genuine, like, sort of Russian patriotic connection to this corrupt regime in Kyiv? And, you know, they wanted to sort of break away and sort of create their own independent republic, which is basically what's happened now.
Yeah, there was. And you know who did everything in their power to quash it? Well, Kyiv and Moscow.
Putin, yeah.
That's the thing.
Say, yeah. And see, that's where I think that's what really throws people off, is that Moscow has been sort of hostile to this, you know, nationalist, patriotic movement in Donbass from the very beginning, right? Is that more or less your takeaway? Yeah, yeah.
Well, we have the documents. We have the proof. We've got lots of proof of this. This isn't conjecture, people. I mean, it's like you have Medvedchuk, like this pro-Russian, again, one of these interesting pro-Russian, a pro-Russian oligarch in Ukraine. And so he was supposed to be, you know, like leading the network we can get into Medvedchuk in a bit, but basically, you know, he was the guy that the Azov, the people were swapped out for. He was captured by Ukraine before the SMO. In fact, I argue that his arrest was what caused the SMO. No other reason. And so you have a situation where he's freed and he goes on some interview with a Belarusian channel and he says, well, you know, he reveals a lot of stuff. One of the things he reveals is that, actually, Poroshenko wanted to give away Donbass to Russia. He didn't want it. He said, take it. And Moscow refused.
Sorry to interrupt you, but this is going back to like 2014 when Poroshenko was willing to basically let these Russian separatists, or whatever you want to call them, Russian nationalists, establish their own independence. Moscow does not want this to happen, which is really sort of even just doesn't make any sense, you know, if you haven't been following these details closely.
Yeah. Well, the reason why they didn't want to is it's Kintainsk 1 and 2 agreements, right? I mean, it's quite clear. And who also helped write that? Medvedchuk. So he knows what he's talking about. So these agreements were quite clear. The goal was to keep Donbass in Ukraine. Why? It was so that there would, well, first of all, because oligarchic interests. There's like a lot of really banal reasons for why it's profitable for the oligarchs to keep Donbass in Ukraine. So, for example, you know, if you're part of Russia proper, you have like, you know, in terms of like, buying stuff, right? You can't like mark up stuff, you know, like if there's Russian gas or other Russian natural resources. There's going to be that. You can make more money if there's an artificial line dividing Donbass from Russia, and prices can shoot up like 20% just because of this line, because you know, within Russia there are laws, and then and Ukraine is technically a foreign country, so you can make a profit basically, especially if you control all the industry in Russia, and you know, you can't make as much of a profit selling to Russians because, you know. And so, but hey, you jump over the border and boom, 20-15%. So just even on that banal level, like they had an incentive to not let Donbass join Russia. You know, they lose money. And then on another level, because they wanted Donbass and its network of oligarchs, and the, you know, most people in Ukraine live in either Kyiv or Donbass. It's heavily populated, or used to be. And so they wanted these guys to continue being the deciding region in politics in Ukraine. So why would you want to, you know, peel them off? You'd want them to stay in Ukraine and keep that many people living in the west of Ukraine. There's no industry in the west of Ukraine. There's no money in the west of Ukraine. There's a pretty little town called Lvov or Lviv and it's quite cute. But other than that, there's nothing going on there. So, you know, Donbass was always, so goes Donbass, so goes Ukraine. So they wanted to keep it in there. And again, this isn't conjecture. You can just read Minsk 1 and 2. That was the whole point. And then obviously we have other people coming out and sharing with us that, yeah, offers were made to just hand over Donbass to Russia, and Russia refused. So yeah, I think that merits a more skeptical look at what's been happening there and at this whole war. What's it really about then?
Right, exactly. Well, so if like Poroshenko was basically in like the Ukrainian political leadership at the time, was basically willing to concede to the demands of the Donbass patriots, or however you want to describe it. I mean, why was this conflict, why has it been going on for the past almost 10 years now? I mean, what was causing, I mean, because, you know, you listen to Putin and some of these Russian officials describe the conflict. It's been going on since 2014. The Ukrainian army and military and some of these militias have been attacking civilians in Donbass and, you know, bombing city centers and things like this. So what is causing this conflict? If Ukraine was willing to give it up, I mean, what led to the bloodshed?
Well, basically it was the chaos unleashed by Euromaidan. So at first it seemed like Yanukovych would win because the protests initially petered out. And so that it was the west of Ukraine that made the first move, where they basically almost declared independence from Kiev. And, you know, there was, they were beating up public officials, they were storming government buildings, and that was in the west. But then they won. It's funny, like the Poroshenko is also a Donbass oligarch. He's also from there. He's also part of that network, you know? So did the Westerners really win? Did they really get their guy in power? He's also one of these people. He's also from there. Right. Neither Poroshenko nor Zelensky even spoke Ukrainian. I mean, it's like, so the Westerners didn't get down. And then it was in the East when things kicked off, where there was rebellions. And, you know, what really happened was just that people like Strelkov, they gathered men and they stormed government buildings. And they basically said, that's it. We're not going to be part of this Kiev new regime. And we're going to be Nova Russia now, Nova Russia. And so in some places it was successful. In some places they took these buildings. In other places they were repulsed by the secret police, which was sent in. And that's a whole chapter of this thing, of the story, that's very interesting, because basically the people who were calling the shots were the oligarchs again. You know, they were making calls, they were getting visits, and the greatest example is Mariupol, which was basically, it was in the hands of the rebels. Like they could have had it, and they got the call. They got the call from Akhmetov, who's this oligarch, and Mariupol is his. It's obviously going to be exporting stuff if it becomes Russian or, you know, contested or whatever. He didn't want that. So first he promised a lot of stuff, basically. And initially he was pro the Donbass rebels. A lot of these oligarchs switched sides several times because they didn't think it would be that serious. You know, they thought they would, they're always trying to recruit these basically armed gangs into their employ. So they were like, okay, they were playing with fire. They figured they could control it. And it got a little bit out of hand. But Mariupol is one of those examples where, What decided the fate of Mariupol before the SMO started? What decided it? It was literally one oligarch who said, it's going to be with Kiev. We're not going to allow you to secede. And there were a lot of moments like that in Donbass that were decided literally by the intervention or the direct order of one oligarch or another. No. And people are talking about geopolitics. They're talking about shared language, shared history, the legacy of Catherine the Great, you know, all this bullshit. And it's like, no, what really decided all of this was the say-so of one oligarch or another. And people don't understand that Russia is not a country with oligarchs. You know, Russia is an oligarchy that, you know, has a country attached to it. So Moscow, well, anyway, we can get more into Moscow's involvement and all that, but that's just a very concrete example. The fate of a city that was then so heavily fought over, it was already in the hands of the rebels, but then boom, they get the call, done. That should get people thinking that maybe there's more to this than meets the eye. If they knew this, I don't know. Do people know this? Do they just plug their ears and not want to listen to this? It's ridiculous. Everyone knows it in Russia.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I remember you guys discussing that in the podcast you did with Riley recently, and that, yeah, I wasn't even aware of that, but it does make a lot more sense now, you know, kind of knowing this background. So maybe we can kind of, well, I don't know if you have any other points you want to make, but I definitely want you to kind of talk about how, like, the Russian patriotic community, like the genuine, like, Russian nationalists, what have they been saying about this simmering conflict with Ukraine? And certainly, you know, now that the quote-unquote special military operation has been launched, what are they saying about how it's been prosecuted, that sort of thing? You want to get into that information?
Well, I guess the background is that, like you said, it's been going on for a while. And so, you know, these guys, these patriots, they didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, some of them are literally Donbass veterans, like Strelkov and like every other one of these bloggers on Telegram. They served, or like they fought in these militias, and so they had a very, like, on the ground perspective of what was going on. Now, their accusations before this thing even started was that, well, I'll start with the most extreme one, was that Moscow was literally killing off militia commanders, like pro-Novorossian, these separatists, these Russians, that basically Moscow was assassinating them.
So Moscow, like, so you're saying Moscow was assassinating the pro-Russian independent, you know, like, dissident movement in Donbass that was rebelling against Kyiv, who you would think would ostensibly be allies with Moscow, but Moscow was actually actively targeting them during this time period?
That's what they say. And they're all pretty unanimous about it. I mean, Motorola, Mozgovoy, a lot of these small, he was the first, I guess, the first big one. But yeah, targeted killings of these. I mean, even the guy who came in to rule over Donbass when Russia finally decided to intervene, Zakharchenko. I mean, that one is pretty cut and dry because, can you still hear me? Yeah, because his replacement, I think, off the top of my head, I think it's Kurchenko. He's friends with Holomoisky, and he's got lots of friends in Moscow. So, okay, so what happened was Zakharchenko comes in, and he nationalizes Donbass, and everyone's very pro-Zakharchenko. They saw him as this, like, hardcore, real Russian patriot, you know, real, a guy who looked after the interests of Donbass. He's killed, and very suspiciously. And so immediately after he's out of the way, Pushilin, the guy who's still around now, moves in with Kurchenko. And if you ever look at a photo of Kurchenko, I mean, it's like, you know, he looks very, very deranged. Let's just put it that way. I have an article about this, and people can check it out. But and all of a sudden, while these territories in Donbass are under the control of the rebels and ostensibly, you know, pro-Russia, whatever, and supported by Russia, this Moscow oligarch swoops in and starts looting it worse than the oligarchs were looting it before all this stuff started. And I mean, it was insane what he was getting away with. And all this, again, in the context of, like, an existential conflict, right? And before that, obviously, was Zakharchenko. You have a guy who's nationalizing the economy, who is, you know, trying to do right by people. So he's killed off. This guy moves in, and all of a sudden, price gouging, people getting laid off. He's playing hardcore, using, again, gangs to intimidate workers and not pay wages. I mean, really, like, 90s level, just total. And this is allowed to happen under Moscow's auspices. Like, this man was allowed to loot Donbass because he has friends in Moscow. And he's good friends with Holomoisky as well, who's ostensibly on the other side. And we have even phone calls between, I've never actually written about this, maybe I should. We have phone calls between these two guys, between Holomoisky, and you get kind of like an understanding of their relationship from this phone call. There was a really funny one, a recent one, where he's complaining to Holomoisky that, like, oh, what's going on here? Like, I'm being pressed out of some of my holdings. And Holomoisky is basically like teasing him and saying, well, you know what it is. And he's got this very funny Jewish accent. And it's so, but yeah, these people all know each other. They're all in cahoots. And occasionally they stab each other in the back. And these stabs in the back are a better explanatory factor for why conflict emerges than any kind of geopolitical imperative. You know, from America's point of view, yeah, they actually usually Americans, but in the interests of the American empire, they will actually proactively like engage in regime change and everything like that. I don't think anyone can deny that. Russia? No, Russia does not do anything to actively defend its geopolitical interests because Russia doesn't have any. The elite don't have any. The best example is like, ostensibly, this war is to keep Ukraine out of NATO. Finland joins NATO right on the border with Russia. Not a peep. You know, it's like...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, and so also, I don't buy it.
Yeah, and also like all of the objectives and like the goals of the special military operation. I mean, if you look at them, it's all like the exact opposite has happened. You know, Ukraine is even more anti-Russian now than it probably was before the war started. There's been a lot of obviously hostilities and just, you know, casualties. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people have died. You know, I don't know if we'll ever really know. I don't know what accurate is. You know, so it's like all of the, and this is something that I know you've written about. I know Riley's talked about and written about how all of the ostensible goals of the special military operation have just totally backfired. And it's like the exact opposite has happened.
Yeah. I mean, we just, but it seems obvious to us, but it clearly it's not obvious to the vast majority of people who are following this conflict, like on the pro-Russian English speaking side. Everything's going according to plan, according to them.
I remember listening to shortly after the special military operation began in like late February of 2022. I remember listening to Gonzalo Lira, and Gonzalo Lira is obviously a very intelligent man. You know, he's got a lot of important things to say. I hope he's okay. I don't know what is going on with him. I know he got picked up by the Ukrainian Secret Service or whatever, and I don't think he's been heard from since. And this has been a couple months now, but 22. And he was just going on about how Russia was basically on the verge of taking the entire country. And it was only a matter of weeks or even days before Zelensky would be gone. And, you know, and now look at it, we're over a year and a half into it, and it's still just as protracted as ever, it seems like.
Well, the thing about Lira is that nothing about him makes any sense. I mean, let's just start with the fact that he was living in Ukraine. I mean, I knew him back when he was Coach Red Pill. He was basically selling really bullshit PUA. I mean, he was a scammer and a grifter. And he was just sort of like in the kind of dissident right sphere trying to, you know, make a name for himself or whatever. So he goes to Ukraine and he's living in Ukraine. And he's telling everybody what a great country Ukraine is to come live there, get a wife and live this like trad lifestyle or whatever in Ukraine. And then overnight, all of a sudden Ukraine's a corrupt shithole and like, you know, go Russia. Well, if you were so pro-Russia, why weren't you living in Russia? You know, like that part of the story doesn't really add up. Where's your trad wife? I don't know. Like everything about him appears to. And then that initial time that he was arrested, why did they let him go? It followed then by the next question, why did he stay in Ukraine and continue making ostensibly pro-Russia propaganda?
Right.
And for a year, none of this makes any sense. None of it adds up. Also, his association with Donbas Dievushka and other really suspect people. Donbas Dievushka, if you don't know, is one of these. She's still around. She's actually bigger and better than ever. And she was this woman from New Jersey who pretended that she was Russian and that she had family there. She did a fake accent and everything. And so she also got her hand. She was one of the first people to get their hands on these Discord leaks from I think it was Department of Defense leaks, and she was probably the one that photoshopped them to make it seem like Ukraine had lost more and Russia had lost less. So and then she's also collecting all this money to donate. Well, first of all, I mean, you'd get in trouble for actually donating to the Russian military, or you know, luckily for her, we have no proof that she donated anything. So she's collecting this money to send to these brave Russian fighters. We have no proof that she... We have proof of the money going in. We have no proof of it going out. We know that she lied about her Russian heritage. And then after she's exposed for basically lying about everything, she has any claim to like, and before that, like she was running this group with a bunch of girls. Very few of them were Russian. I don't know if any of them were Russian. And they were basically doing softcore porn. And I know because I talked to one of them, Hick, as her profile picture. She's a Greek girl. And, you know, like an autist, I asked her, you know, what's your opinion on the, like, the distribution of the troops or whatever? And she was like, hello, I don't know what you're talking about. And so they had this weird operation where they have these horny American old timers, mostly interacting with these sexy Russian girls who are patriotic or whatever. Few of whom are Russian, clearly don't know anything about patriotism or conservatism or anything. It's just a weird grift. She's exposed. RT then, after she's exposed, after we find out she's been lying and possibly stealing money, they give her a glowing profile. And now she's bigger and better than ever. And this is the kind of people that Gonzalo Lira associates with. So it's just, if you prod and look a little bit deeper, just like with the oligarch situation, if you just kind of stop looking at it from like these big, you know, overarching meta narratives, like if you stop looking at play as like an exercise in learning history and like all this stuff, and just look at the names of the people involved, look at the money, you know, look at what they say and how it is different from what they do, all of a sudden you start realizing that something here is very suspect. So yeah, and that's I don't know where he is now, Lira, if he's in custody or whatever, but frankly, I mean, the stuff that guy was saying when he was Coach Red Pill, when he was, you know, all of it was just so absurd. And but hey, that's just, you know, the stupid swine masses, they love that stuff. Oh my god, they love them dumb Bastievichka, they love Lira. The dumber the narrative that is sold to them, the more easily and readily they gobble it up. So, I mean, good for him. I mean, he's a really good grifter. So my hat's off to him for that.
Well, and there's a lot of, as you've been explaining, there's a lot of that going on, whether it's in the alternative media or just actually on the ground. There's a lot of grifting, a lot of very shady things going on. And I think part of what feeds into it, at least in the West, is there is this desire. And I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I would love to see at least one government standing up to the satanic West, as Putin calls it, and really, you know, expose these things and be a genuine nationalist resistance to this whole New World Order scheme. But the more you dig into the details, it just appears to be that is really not the case at all.
And well, actually, there is a country like that. It's called Belarus.
But they
don't talk about Belarus, and you know why? Because Lukashenko occasionally allows himself to say some interesting things. You know, Lukashenko is the one that spilled the beans about this secret renting out Donbass and Crimea to Ukraine scheme that apparently was in the secret peace treaty. His TV channels in Belarus, they were covering the war fairly. They were talking about how this was a catastrophe. I was there when this all started. You know, I was watching it, and let me tell you, the coverage was totally different. So, you know, and then with COVID, right? Everyone knows that Belarus was like the only country that didn't shut down. I mean, I was there for that. And even when the city of Minsk, which is liberal, right? And they tried to overthrow Lukashenko in 2019, there were these massive, like 85% of them were women, these goddamn rampaging sluts. Funded by Western money and by like a troika of three lesbians that was leading the whole damn movement. So they almost toppled Lukashenko, but the man hung on there. He didn't run like Yanukovych. And so what happened was he didn't shut down for COVID. Minsk, the city, tried to impose all these restrictions for it lasted for like a month. I remember it very distinctly. They started forcing people to mask up. Police started harassing people. It's on the TV on this like a live show, and he starts chewing them out and saying like, don't you have anything better to do than to harass the people? You're going to drop all these measures right now. It's illegal. You're not allowed to do this. And they did. So, I mean, he chewed out the police mayor. He chewed out the police. He chewed out the mayor. He chewed out the health person. It was great. I mean, that's what Lukashenko is. And he'll go on the TV. He'll do these interviews with Westerners or whatever. Now, Putin never says anything that interesting, I got to be honest. Like when he does these interviews with the Westerners, everyone like hangs on to his every word. And it's like, you know, it's just politicians speak. I don't know why they're so captivated by him. When Lukashenko speaks, it's interesting. He's like, he's lambasting them. He's talking about Assange. You know, he's all over the place. He's great. So why not lose it? Like, if you're pro, you know, anti-West, if you're pro resistance to the globalist order, why not listen to what Lukashenko has to say? Lukashenko said that people with suitcases full of money came from the WEF or from, you know, one of these health terrorist organizations. They showed up in Belarus and they tried to bribe him and he said no. Well, don't you think they probably did that in Russia as well? And yet we don't hear what the Russian answer is. All we know is that they did draconian lockdowns. They harassed people for months on end. They force vaxxed people. And right nearby, there's a neighbor that has the same climate, the same genetic material. They somehow survived COVID without mandatory vaccination. And yet, for some reason, no one seems to notice that. No one in Russia seems to be like, oh, wow, we have a case A and a case B. And things kind of worked out okay for Belarus, huh? It's because they all got bribed. It's because they all took the money. You know, you should read Riley's stuff. He really covers the extent. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely am very familiar with it. And he continues to cover it. And Russia's cooperation with the World Health Organization and all these other globalist institutions. Well, and see, and that's another question I have is like there does appear to be like a genuine hostility towards Russia from this very hostile elite running America, running the American media, running the U.S. federal government, and even like the wider Western world. You know, you see the same thing in Britain or in, you know, some of these big EU countries. So what explains that? Like, how would you respond to that? I mean, why is there this genuine hostility towards Putin and to Russia if they are basically more or less on the same page, at least when it comes to COVID and some of these other, you know, bigger globalist type agendas?
It's the same thing that I have been talking, like, just extrapolate it a little bit larger. It's a turf war. Russia, listen, anytime, you know, in this latest presser, Putin talks about how hard he tried to get Russia into NATO.
Exactly. Well, and I've been following this for a while. I mean, his entire career since he came onto the political scene, he's been just bending over backwards for the West and trying to do everything to either get into NATO or to, you know, play nice with the West when, like, they clearly hate him, it seems like, anyways. Maybe that's just a front. I don't know. But it's like he really has bent over backwards to appease the West, and look where it's gotten him.
Well, yeah. So there's, you know, this is kind of like a big topic. I don't even know how to approach it. Like, on the most basic level, the people who run America are Jews, and the Jews have a special hatred for Russians. One of the reasons why they really hate Russians, it's kind of weird. Like, I get into religion as well. I was reading the texts of Origen, and he's like this one of these early Jewish Christians. And, you know, he really hates the Hyperboreans, and he's, you know, that's the Russians that he's talking to, his people. And why won't they accept that the Jews are better than they are? You know, so, and this hatred it's so deep. I mean, it's like the hatred of the Tsar, and, you know, the Tsars weren't particularly mean to them. You know, this hatred of the church wasn't particularly mean to them either. So there's that level of, I mean, all these people like Kagan and the Newlands and the, you know, all of them. I mean, even Kushner. I mean, the Kushniers. They're from Belarus. So there's a definite ethnic hatred of Russians by these Jews, and the best proof of that is what happened with the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, Putin himself said, you know, 85% of the Bolsheviks, and there was a documentary that came out on Russian TV, which went through the archives, and I broke it down and I shared screenshots from that documentary, proving conclusively that there was practically no Russians to speak of revolution. It was all foreigners. There's a lot of Latvians. It was a bunch of Chechens and Georgians. And the vast, vast majority were Jews. And so, you know, when given a chance, what did they do to Russia? I mean, they absolutely looted it. They destroyed it. They massacred millions. And then in the 90s, they did the same thing. And so you see the same MO. These people really hate Russia, and that on some fundamental level, that is like a key thing that you have to understand. As for why they hate Putin specifically, that is quite baffling. Because, for example, Putin has routinely been called by Israeli media as the most Jew-friendly president or leader Russia has ever had. You know, I guess they don't count Lenin as that or something like that. But you know, when Putin comes to power, first of all, with Yeltsin's entire government was, I have the receipts, I have the full list, like Minister of Economy, Minister of Interior, it's all Jewish, every single one. So that's Yeltsin. And then Putin is the inheritor of all this. And the assumption that I was actually operating under for many years as well, because of the conflict that he had with, what's his name, Hodorkovsky, over Yukos oil and all that, I was under the impression that he was slowly, methodically destroying these oligarchic gangs, and he was basically making Russia more Russian. But I found out that actually that's not very true. Yes, there was this one public spat that he had. And since then, though, what's happened is that he's done the classic Trump maneuver, where he has cozied up to a different faction, supposedly, of Jews, which are the Chabadniks. So, you know, Trump was hated by liberal Jews, but the conservative Jews, Chabad and those kind of, like Netanyahu's people, Likudniks, they're pretty pro-Trump. They for him recognizing Jerusalem as the capital. In fact, Russia a couple days ago did the same thing. They moved their embassy to Jerusalem. I have an article that's going to come out soon where I explain that Russia has followed in the steps of Trump by basically de facto moving to recognize Jerusalem, which is a big
wow,
deal.
I didn't even realize that. That's very revealing right there.
In Putin's biography, he talks quite a bit about how much he loves Jews. So, you know, he says that he had these neighbors who were Jews, and that he loved going over to them and studying the Torah with them, and that he really enjoyed when they explained the Talmud and the Torah to him.
Jeez.
Hold on, I'm blanking. Oh, yes, his judo teacher, this guy who, and Russia at the time, a lot of these fight clubs were hubs of gangster criminal activity. This is a well-known thing that a lot, because it was, all martial arts was actually banned in the Soviet Union. So these were kind of underground. And what they would do is they'd get like these street fighting hooligans into the dojos. They'd train them up a bit, and then they'd become racketeering gangs. They'd like go out and shake down businesses and help one oligarch, you know, beat out another oligarch. That's a whole other chapter of Russia, the late 80s and the early 90s. And it's interesting. So Putin was one of these hooligans, and he joined with the judo gang of this, oh my God, I think it's Rybakov. I'm blanking on him right now, but it's a famous story. He joined this guy, and he writes that this man was like a very powerful mentor to him. And so he attends his funeral, and he's so visibly emotionally moved by it that he goes off into the distance without his security, and it's at the death of his Jewish judo mentor. Then he has this Jewish teacher of German who he really, really praises, and he makes a big deal out of buying her an apartment and taking care of her in Israel. She moved to Israel, and so he somehow found out about her, and he starts making sure that she's financially taken care of, and the Jewish media very favorably tells this story of his everlasting loyalty to his Jewish German teacher. You know, in Russia there's also a K-12 system, K-11, and I'm sure he had other teachers as well, but for some reason not all of them have gotten apartments. Let's just put it that way. But the Jewish one did.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, and then, that's very bizarre. Well, it's not bizarre because this is the Jew. I mean, that's a thing that is sort of, at least I didn't understand the extent of it, like the role that Jews play, continue to play, even in Russia itself. I mean, you know, I completely agree with you. I mean, the Jews basically run America and the wider Western world, but they appear to even have a major influence still to this day in Russia.
Well, where would they go? I mean, they ran the Soviet Union, so where would they go? Like, there wasn't any pogroms that I'm aware of, you know? They're still there. So, another thing is Primakov, right? And this is the former intelligence chief, a top spook in Russia, who comes up with the Primakov doctrine, which is basically like Russia needs to push back and get a seat back at the table with the West. Primakov, I mean, I've written about him as well. I haven't. His real name is Finkelstein. You know, go figure. The head spook. You know, the guy monitoring Russians, arresting them in the dead of the night, doing. And under his watch, all this criminality is allowed to flourish. You know, so it's interesting that you have these sprawling spook states, and yet they can't seem to arrest any criminals. Now, isn't that interesting? So. Now, Putin's in that milieu. He's around Yeltsin and his people. And before that, he's with Sobchak. Sobchak marries a Jewish woman, of course. He's the mayor of St. Petersburg. And he's one of the top gangster bandits of the 90s. And what he does is he just steals a lot of money. And he sends it to the West and parks it in France, I believe. And so he has a daughter named Ksenia Sobchak, who's very famous. She's like the Paris Hilton of Russia. And she has like lots of interesting gossip about all of the ruling elite. And so Putin is very close to the Sobchak family because that's his boss. Sobchak dies in a suspicious helicopter crash. I believe it was a helicopter crash. And Putin basically says that he will always take care of the remainder of the Sobchak family, which is the Jewish wife who is in politics. She's a very vocal liberalizer in Russia. She's like this like old fat lady. With these giant grandma glasses that sits in the Duma for I don't know how many years it's been, deeply hated, deeply reviled, deeply corrupt. And her whore daughter who runs around and is friends with everybody who's anybody in Moscow's upper crust elite. And these people are, you know, Putin's close friends. And even though Sobchak, they will critique Putin for, I don't know, being too pro-Russian at times, no one ever touches them. They're allowed to do anything. They have full reign. So, yeah. And then going down the list some more, Putin's right-hand man is a Jewish banker who's called Putin's personal banker. I think his name is Kovalchuk. Kovalchuk pretty much owns all of Russia's media. And he actually he's been on a buying spree recently. He's been buying up the Western affiliated channels, like, you know, they'll have Western shows, but they dub it over into Russian. So he's been buying up that sort of content over the last 2 years. I mean, the man is probably he's like the Murdoch of Russia, and he enjoys almost a near monopoly. And if you know anything about Russian TV, there's nothing but filth on it. And so, you know, you'd think that Putin could
You had a good – sorry to interrupt you. I was going to mention real quick the number one TV personality. It sounds like he's one of the big political commentators, this guy Vladimir – how do you pronounce his last name? Soloviev?
Yeah. Real name Shapiro.
Right. Yeah, of course. And he's like the leading commentator in Russia, right? And he's sort of presented as – correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't he sort of like a Russian nationalist type? But like a kosher nationalist, right?
Yeah, that's the thing, that, you know, he says this ridiculous stuff and then the West picks it up and says, like, look at the hatred that's coming out of Russia. But yeah, he's literally like Ben Shapiro in America, you know, right. A total kosher. But he actually takes it a step further. He's even worse than Ben Shapiro because he sells like Kabbalah courses and he's much bigger than Ben Shapiro is. And, you know, he will actively attack Russian identity. As I have written about and I have provided evidence for in my articles, he literally chimps out anytime anybody talks about Slavic identity or Russian identity. He says his view is that Russia belongs to the Khazars. He says that our people were here first, you're squatting on our land, and we allow you to live here. He said that on live TV to a Russian. Like, we're the ones who run this place, this joint. So,
talk about,
and he's a
hotspot right there.
Yeah, and so he's like he's number one in Russia. He has been for many years, and close friend of Putin apparently. I mean, he's been given awards. He's made billions of rubles. I mean, he's a like I'm not even like we're talking like he's probably got like, I mean, I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars is how much money he's made in Russia. And his entire show is just Jews or Armenians, but I repeat myself. And so he just like, he lets all these people on, and they're all like, I mean, he has little Mossad and like little IDF people regularly on his show. Like Yaakov Kedmi, he's like this constant guest. And so it's basically like, and everyone understands that it's just a bunch of Jews talking about how politics are going to be run in Russia, the mainstream view of things. And to some extent, they're listened to by the government. And so it's kind of like a back and forth type thing. It's a Sanhedrin.
Right.
Televised Sanhedrin.
Oh, wow. It's incredible. And again, it's like, you'd like to think that there's some sort of alternative to this, you know, Jewish-run system in the West, but it sounds like it's just as bad in Russia. And I want to bring up another character in this who's also, surprise, surprise, happens to have Jewish ancestry. And that's this guy that heads the Wagner Group, which is this like private, it's like a private military organization, right? And I'm not sure exactly what its relationship is, yeah, like how it's funded. I actually asked Riley, and I don't think he really knew all the details, but it's basically like a private military organization, and it's operating in Ukraine. And there's been this like budding conflict between it and its leader, Jin, who again is at least half Jewish, right? On one side, I think on his, yeah, I don't know if it's his father or mother, but even on Wikipedia, it confirms this. So here's another character involved in this, and you know, sort of like an oligarch type character. And is having this open dispute, open conflict almost with the Russian government and the Ministry of Defense. So what is going on with this situation? What's the latest with this? And I don't know if you have any other comments on it.
Well, you know, with Prigozhin, it's according to Strelkov, he's supported by Kirienko. And Kirienko is the guy who makes all, he's the chief of staff for the Kremlin. And he's been around, he was prime minister first. He's pre-Putin. He's been around for a while. And so Kirienko is basically the guy who decides who's allowed into the club. And he's more than just Jewish. Like, he's literally the descendant of a prominent Czechist, like, who was close to Lenin and awarded a pistol as a, like an autographed or whatever, like a personalized pistol by Lenin as a gift for his services. Oh yeah, Solovyov's family, according to some researchers, staffed the concentration camps. Like they ran the gulags, the Feldmans and the Shapiros. You know, the first guy who was running the Czech, and Dzerzhinsky, right? He may have been purely Pole, but you know, his wife, I talk about as well, he married into a very Jewish, very rich family. So it's all Jews. I mean, Stalin married a Jewish woman as well. So like, if you weren't actually Jewish, your only option was to somehow marry in. And even then you'd be kind of like a second sort. And so Kirienko's a big fan of Dzerzhinsky, who's a mass murderer. I mean, like a brutal man. And he tried to put up his statue on the in front of the KGB dungeon. It's right in the center of Moscow. It's called the Lubyanka. And you know, Russian society protested this, and the government tried to do everything they could to discredit these protesters by portraying them as pro-Ukrainian. But well, what happened was the people came back with the counterproposal. Let's put up a statue to Alexander Nevsky, you know, this legendary prince that saved Russia. And the government immediately dropped it, and they were like, well, if we can't have Iron Felix, then you're not going to get anything at all. And that's Kirienko. That was his initiative. So this guy is in love with Bolshevik mass murderers. He's descended from them, and he's still in power. He's in a very powerful position. Chief of staff is no laughing matter, and nobody in that. He's also some, you know, that who's the guy who runs the number one state bank? I mean, it's not state. It's like, you know, there's no real state banks anymore. I think everybody knows that, right? But the number one bank in Russia, Sberbank, German Gref. I mean, he's a Kabbalist. Talks about it. He says it informs his life. It informs his life philosophy. He you know, who was running the vaccines thing? You know, it was Ginsburg. He's the guy who comes up with Sputnik V. And Riley wrote a lot about Ginsburg. Well, Ginsburg, that doesn't sound like a Russian name, does it?
Right.
You go down the list. Exactly. You just, yeah. It's just all of them, man. It's every single one of them. And I don't understand how, like, I don't say this to, like, support Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine, it's even more blatant. I mean, Zelensky invited his entire synagogue into power with him. I mean, everyone there has been Jewish since forever. You know, even Poroshenko, I think he was lying, but you know, he claimed he was Jewish as well. And the Israelis seem to think Jerusalem Post said that yeah, he's one of us. You know, Yatsenyuk, who was put into power with Newland, he's Jewish as well. I mean, it's all every single one of them. Tymoshenko, Jewish. Holomoysky, Jewish. You know, and so now we get to Prigozhin. Well, Prigozhin's like literally a criminal. I mean, he served time. I mean, he had a serious sentence. And then somehow miraculously,
real quick, do you have any idea what he served for? What was his crime?
Off the top of my head, I think it was like a racketeering. There was multiple charges. He was just a gangster.
From what little I know about him, he definitely strikes me as like basically like an oligarch gangster type individual.
Yeah. So, and then miraculously, you know, most people, when they get out of prison, they're the dregs of society and they have to work at the, I don't know, like the Red Lobster for the rest of their life and meet parole and all that sort of thing. But this guy rebounds rather quickly. And all of a sudden he's got a catering company and he's catering to the Kremlin. He's catering to Putin personally. He's not Putin's chef. He doesn't know how to cook, but, He was providing the food at these official gatherings and probably making a tidy profit off of that as well. So we go from that selling hot dogs. So the hot dog salesman who served time for a serious crime is now all of a sudden in charge of a mercenary outfit. But you know, with Wagner, there's actually a little bit more to it because it was started by Utkin, who's an actual Nazi. Like he's 1488. And he's GRU, and I don't know how much it's true or not, but in Soviet lore, the GRU was like the good guys. Like they're the ones who are sort of like the patriots. And just judging by his career history, he's fighting Chechens. He's fighting in, I think, in Transnistria near Moldova. He's in Syria. So, you know, I think it's fair to say he's a patriotic guy. And he's a nationalist, obviously, because, you know, he's into Nazism, which is really, really big in Russia in the 90s and the 00s and the aughts. And then there's another guy like a Lotus, who was the guy in charge of capturing Soledar. And Lotus is he was in the regular army, but he ran afoul of Shoigu and his buddies, and he was charged. Like they tried to put him away in prison, but he managed to make it into Wagner instead. It's an interesting story. But so there are a lot of good people, I would say, in Wagner. There are a lot of people who, you know, have their priorities straight, who aren't oligarchs. But they had to choose the PR guy, the guy with who goes to get them the money and the shells. Well, who would the Kremlin listen to? I guess they said. You know, who's the Kremlin comfortable doing dealings with? I know. Let's find a criminal Jewish gangster. That's the only guy that the Kremlin will do business with. So in comes Prigozhin. And
that's when Prigozhin comes in, yeah. Did he found Wagner? Do you know?
Wagner, from what I understand, was founded by Utkin. And it's his call sign. It's, you know, Wagner was his, like, you know, like, your nickname when you're in the military.
Right.
So it's in honor of him.
So do you more or less view this dispute between Wagner and Prigozhin and the Ministry of Defense as yet another, like, you know, broader, like, oligarchic battle essentially or conflict?
Well, yeah, there's definitely that. But the thing is these oligarchs will tell you interesting stuff. I mean, Medvedchuk told us that, hey, you know, Putin turned down the deal to take Donbass without any blood. And we know this isn't like imagine they totally ignore this. They ignore the secret treaty. They ignore Medvedchuk's words. They ignore the origins of Wagner. They ignore everything, these 5D people. Everything I've talked to you about today, it doesn't exist in their world. They will never touch it. You know, the question is why? There's probably several answers for that. But Medvedchuk tells us very interesting things. And you can't accuse him of being an agent of the West in these people's paradigm, because he was freed by Putin, by Roman Abramovich, actually, who is another powerful Jew in Russia who can apparently, you know, snap his fingers and make a prisoner swap. So he's freed by Roman Abramovich. And then he's telling people that Russia was actually offered Donbass, but they didn't want it. So how are you like supposed to say that that's just Western disinformation? This is a guy who was ransomed out by Russia. Why would they ransom out a traitor or like a guy who's spreading Western disinfo? I think he's telling the truth. And so with Prigozhin, you have the same thing. I mean, the guy, I think a lot of what he says is he's telling the truth. And he's placed in a position where he would know the truth about some of this stuff because he's involved in all of it. So just because he's Jew or like a lot of these oligarchs, it doesn't mean you can just ignore everything he said. Besides, these 5D people don't touch the Jewish question. They'll never talk about the Jews anyway. So it's not like they can say, oh, we can't listen to Prigozhin. He's a lying Jewish traitor. You know, they'd never say that. So, you know, on what grounds do they ignore what he has to say? They should have no grounds whatsoever. He's the hero who took Bakhmut, and yet they ignore everything he says because it doesn't fit with their narrative. So I think a lot of what he says is true.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, and I certainly wasn't trying to like dismiss anything. Like his critiques of the Ministry of Defense seem very, very valid. And as you point out in your blog, a lot of the things that he's saying, some of these, you know, Russian patriots and military hardliners and nationalists are saying the same thing, and they've been saying the same thing for almost 10 years now, with how the Russian government has responded to this whole conflict in the Donbass.
Well, do you know that there's actually a group of military officers who are running for president? Did you know about that?
No, I didn't. Nuh-uh.
Nobody knows about that. Wow. And if you listen to these guys, again, I would love to hear some Sacker disciple say, oh, this is the sixth column, the treacherous patriots who want to destroy Russia. These are all men who have served. They're older. They've been in Afghanistan, most of them, Chechnya. They have fought Russia's wars, you know, messy as they were. And I was going to translate what they were saying. I guess I'll put it. I did do their presidential announcement thing. I covered it on the blog. But the leader that they chose.
When was this, by the way? When did you cover this? Recently?
I don't know, probably 3 months ago.
Okay.
But so, you know, he gave an interview like about a month ago, I guess. And you should hear what he has to say. And I only bring this up because here you have a man who has bled for Russia. You can even see some of the scars he's got. And you should hear what he has to say. He's saying we're being demographically replaced. The Kremlin is deliberately.
Very true.
So is he a liberal sixth columnist? Is he an agent of NATO sent to discredit our Lord and Savior, you know, Vladimir Putin? He says other stuff too. I mean, he talks about the Jews. Strelkov talks about the Jews. Why is it that all the people that the 5D people hate and who they love to talk smack about, why are they always talking smack about the people who will actually, you know, name names and like call things out for what, you know, tell the truth, the hard truth, you know, go after really powerful ethnic lobbies? Why? I mean, Strelkov actually, you know, whatever. I mean, yeah.
By the way, is this the group that's known as the Angry Patriots Club?
No, that's a different group under Strelkov.
That's a different group. Okay. So you're saying that there's actually like a coalition of veterans basically saying the same thing that Prigozhin is saying, same critiques that he's... Yeah, okay, wow.
Even harsher.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. And a lot of the points that they're making is that basically Moscow and the Ministry of Defense in particular is sabotaging the war effort.
Yeah.
And not, you know, fully prosecuting this quote unquote special military operation. So I guess, I mean, I'm going to have to wrap up here in just a minute, but I guess that would probably be my final topic to bring up is like, how do you see this concluding? I mean, it seems like it's such a mess at this point. I don't know really what does a realistic solution to this conflict look like? Or well, is there one? I mean, maybe that's the whole point of it, is there's not meant to be, you know, a genuine resolution. It's just supposed to continue. And I certainly think the neocons in Washington, D.C. would like to see that, you know, anything that would weaken Russia and weaken Ukraine, for that matter, anything that would harm. It's obviously, I think, you know, they would certainly support that. So maybe this is meant to just drag out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say in their policy papers. You know, it's obvious that the longer this thing drags out, the better it is for Washington. I mean, that's just, I mean, why are they trickling in supplies to Kiev and like pretending that it's, you know, they don't want to, you know, they're so careful with their supplies. If they wanted to, they could send a lot more equipment to Ukraine. But wouldn't that speed up the, you know, the war a little bit? Wouldn't that actually, you know, either finish it or whatever, conclude it in some way or shape or form? No, let's drag it out a little bit. I mean, listen to what the Ukrainians themselves are saying. They're saying, well, they're not, you know, why are they, you know, trickle feeding us this stuff? Well, because they want the conflict to continue longer. That's why.
Right. Still moving gas through Ukraine. They're still supplying Europe with natural resources. I mean, if it were this major, you know, threat to Russia, then why are they continuing to do business with them?
You know, Ukrainian stores are still filled with Russian products, you know, like tomatoes from Krasnodar or whatever. I don't want to say it's a fake war because people are dying. That's not fake, but it's something, man. The not war. Well,
It's like the narratives on both sides are fake, and the sort of perspective that you're outlining here is it makes a lot more sense and really, you know, kind of cuts through the disinfo on both sides.
Well, yeah, I mean, ideally they would have had their 3-day or 2-week campaign, but even then I don't think it would have solved the problem, because what they would have done almost certainly, just, you know, Ukraine, oh my god, at this presser Putin talks about the sanctity of Ukraine as a political entity. He's like, you know, the people who say that we should do away with Ukraine are wrong, is what he says, right? So what they would have done is they would have just put another oligarch, ostensibly more pro-Russian, in power. And then the same damn thing would have repeated itself at the next election cycle. I mean, you can't go one election cycle in Ukraine without some Maidan happening, right? So their whole plan was to basically kick the can down the road, to send in a show of force or whatever. We don't even really know what the full extent of the plan was. But yeah, it almost certainly would not have been the ending of Ukraine as a political entity. It would not have been moving out of the corruption. It would not have been a restructuring of the Ukrainian political system. It would have been, let's put our guy in charge. And, you know, and this guy, in terms of like being pro-Russian, in the sense that like he probably wouldn't continue the war or something. But Medvedchuk, for example, if he was the guy that they were going to put into power, or any of his friends, every single one of them is worse than the next. Like Boyko. Boyko was supposed to also be, he was the leader of this For Life. It was like the, you know, like the Eastern, you know, like Donbass thing, right? They're like, let's, I mean, Boyko is a Jew as well, and he fled to Israel. And there was another guy who was supposed to be their candidate for post of, and he was also Jewish, and he also fled for Israel. I'm forgetting his name. There was two of them. Every single person that these guys could come up with was a Jewish oligarch. And obviously, it was to just put another Jewish oligarch, or possibly Medvedchuk, into power in Kiev. Maybe this would have stopped the war for a while. But then the U.S. would do another color revolution, and Ukrainians, rightfully fed up with the corruption and, you know, the situation in Ukraine, they would have done it again, and more blood would be spilled. And this time, you know, Russia would actually be to blame for this, because unlike the previous Jewish oligarchs, this one Russia would have been put, would have literally instated in power. So that would have actually been an even worse scenario. The right thing to do would be to go into Kiev and then say, you're now part of Russia. We're doing away with this whole system. Welcome back to the family. We're going to cut off the propaganda. We're going to shut down these TV stations, but they can't even hit, they can't even target the propaganda stations while the war is going on. The propaganda, the Ukrainian propaganda is going 24/7 to kill these Russians. Everyone has to go and fight, and like getting people all worked up into a lather. And even if like you're just trying to affect a coup, everyone knows that if you take a, you try to have a, like, you know, you're supposed to take over the radio stations. You're supposed to take over communication channels. You're supposed to, that's like the number one thing that you do in a coup. You take the key areas, you take the ports, you take the roads, you take the government buildings, you take the communication. Russia can't even do that. They don't want to do that. You know why? Because it's owned by some oligarchs, and they don't want to hurt oligarchic profits. What was the grain deal about? Well, it's because Patrushev, the guy sitting on the spook, sitting on the Security Council, and his son Patrushev Jr. Is now the agricultural minister. And so, you know, if Russia can't sell their agricultural product to the international market, this powerful don in Russia who sits on the Security Council and his father, they can't make their money. And so we got to make a special deal so that these oligarchs can keep making money while the war's going on. We'll hand over Snake Island. We'll do all these goodwill gestures, because God forbid Patrushev and his friend and his son should take a hit to the bottom line. They paid a lot of good money to get that seat in the ministry, didn't they? They got to pay off their creditors, don't they? Yeah, the grain must flow. Every single fucking decision can be explained that some person was stood to lose money or to gain money, and that's why this measure was taken. Every single one. And these other people, they all want to talk about geopolitics, geo whatever, but they can't explain the discrepancies. If you assume Russia is this rational state actor pursuing, you know, like the whole Metternich whatever model, right, the whole thing where it's like basically Russia's a big person with personal interests who's trying to secure those interests. You can't explain the NATO-Finland thing, Russia not offering a peep. You can't explain why they waited for 9 years. You can't explain any attempts to actually fix the solution back then. You can't explain the grain deal. You can't explain why they won't target the infrastructure within Ukraine. You can't explain why they won't target communications infrastructure within Ukraine. You can't explain why they won't touch Zelensky, why Zelensky has a personal safety guarantee apparently from the Kremlin, according again to Israeli sources. You can't explain any of it. So all they do is just ignore it. Anyway, sorry, wow. Kind of went off there.
No. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. No, you definitely, I think you provided listeners with a lot to think about for sure. And your blog is excellent. I would encourage people to check it out. It's over on Substack. It's the Slavland Chronicles. And I will, of course, have a link to it. I'd encourage people to support your work, pick up a membership. And definitely there's a lot of material to go through in your archives. So a lot to get caught up on. But Rollo, thanks, man. I really appreciate you taking the time. We'll definitely stay in touch and maybe do this again in the future. Keep up the great work, man.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right, then.
Okay. Thanks, man. Have a good weekend.